This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Think about the times you've heard about big financial scams in recent years. Bernie Madoff's pyramid scheme. Well, there's 2008, just all of it. Then the Enron scandal, and the list goes on and on. But you know, fraud in America is not new. In his new book, Ed Balison looks at fraud's long relationship with capitalism in this country. The book is called Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. Ed is also a professor of history and public policy at Duke University and joins me now in the studio. Welcome.
Well, thanks so much, Frank.
Tell us about this book, because we do think about fraud in terms of these kind of big names. I mean, you name, of course, two of our favorites, Bernie Madoff and P.T. Barnum. But you talk about the relationship between this system, the way our economic system works, and its openness to fraud.
Well, capitalism depends on trust. There is a relationship between buyers and sellers all the time, and buyers presume that they can trust what sellers tell them, or maybe they're suspicious of those claims. And of course, transactions aren't going to happen if some level of trust isn't in place. So there's always the possibility of deception disrupting the apple cart.
And you talk about it's going back to the 1800s, of course, the mantra was, and the saying is caveat emptor, right? The buyer has to beware. And that was really the kind of the prevailing ethos at the time, right?
It was, and there was a preventative dimension to that, or an aspect to it. There was a sense that if you really were going to be suspicious of the people you were doing business with, that you would protect yourself. And that if things went badly with a transaction, you would learn important lessons that would help you be savvier in the future.
This idea, though, stems from a time when buyers and sellers knew each other. These transactions tended to be personal. They tended to be small. They tended to be local. Enter industrial capitalism, when long-term arrangements and both the assemblage of capital and the shipment of goods happens over long distances, and we don't know each other as well.
That's right. So you don't know the parties to the transactions as well. And then, of course, the nature of production gets more complicated with the onward development of technological change. And so it becomes harder to assess the quality of goods on offer. And the same is true for the complexity of financial instruments.
And we don't have too much in the way of government intervention or even a sense that the government should be involved in this. But by the late 1800s, the government does get involved by way of the U.S. Postal Service, right?
So that's one way in. So by the 1860s, 1870s, mail order is becoming an increasingly important aspect of commerce. And that is a form of commercial trade that absolutely separates people. Buyers from sellers. And as soon as that form of commerce emerged, there were unscrupulous fly-by-night firms that would offer things through the mail and then not deliver them.
And so the government does get involved by way of the post office and starts to clamp down on this.
That's right. So the post office actually ended up being the butt of many complaints as a result of this type of deception. And to protect its own reputation, it proposes a law that Congress passes in 1872 that created a new type of crime, mail fraud, pursuing commercial deceit through the use of the mails, and also created a new administrative tool, the fraud order.
And tell us about that.
So with a fraud order, basically the post office just denied your access to the mails. It said you can't. We have evidence that you're engaged in deceptive practices. And so you can either send mail or receive it.
And businesses, of course, reacted and pushed back immediately and probably had a legitimate claim on that first law in terms of what this administrative order did to the idea of due process of law.
That's exactly right. The initial framework set up by the postal system involved no notice, no hearing. You just found out that you no longer were able to get access to the mails because if you sent something out, it would come back to you with a stamp on the letter or the package, which would said fraudulent, and it would have a finger pointing
returned
as well.
Returned to huckster. It said
exactly.
So is this the first time now? Because this is the first time we see a tension between business and government regulation, or at least it's writ large here. Are these the first tensions? Is the first time these two have been in conflict?
Well, no. I mean, there are business interests who have argued for certain kinds of government regulations from the early period of settlement of North America. So their inspection regimes for many export commodities from as early as the early 18th century with respect, say, to tobacco.
So this is interesting because, of course, my question presumed there's a tension between business and regulation. But as you point out in your book, it was businesses who were first asking for regulation to protect themselves.
That's exactly. And so the post office itself in this case in the 1870s is a business that's concerned about its reputation. But that same dynamic played out in many other economic sectors.
All right. So let's talk about this because there's also the need for expertise that, again, going back before the 19th century, let's say, with more personal transactions going on, I kind of know what I'm getting and I can I know what I want to get in a product and I can look the gift horse in the mouth and check its teeth. The fertilizer industry, I think, is a way in which the need for experts rises in the middle of the 19th century. And maybe you can tell us more about that.
By the 1850s, farmers had learned that they could rely on guano, bird droppings from the Pacific coast of South America, to improve their yield. It's an early type of fertilizer. And so demand for this type of product grew enormously. But with that also came unscrupulous operators who would sell fake guano. And the same problem emerged as manufacturers started to produce fertilizer out of offal from particularly from packing houses and bones and such. So how could you tell legitimate fertilizer from spurious fertilizer? Farmers quickly realized that they had limited capacity to do so without reliance on experts from the emerging discipline of chemistry.
So you'd have to know your stuff to be good at this. And this is the idea. Now, again, I need an expert. This is something that we hear over and over again in the complaint against government regulation and big government. Who are these experts telling us what we need and what are the regulations and what are the stipulations that require or that define a quality product over and against a good one? But this goes back a long ways. Right?
It does. And one could have imagined a purely private response here so that chemists could have set themselves up as brokers, as intermediaries, much as credit reporters did or as bond rating agencies did by the 1890s to provide information to the marketplace. The problem here is that who certifies the certifiers? And so even in those domains, there's a growing pressure in many contexts for government oversight and regulation to make sure that the flow of information is trustworthy in particular markets.
And there was a kind of private oversight business. You talk about the role of the press, particularly in the 1700s and 18th, in the colonial period, in identifying fraud for the public.
So long as the government was playing a less expansive role in monitoring the truthfulness of a commercial speech, created a really quite substantial demand for information about both particular markets, but also particular businesses that might be engaging in deceit. And the press answered that at demand. City newspapers covered fraud extensively. National magazines did. And more so than any other set of publications, the trade press really covered the sundry frauds and humbugs in their midst.
But again, this gets to business needing some kind of oversight or looking for oversight, in this case providing it themselves with trade organizations to try to sort out the bad actors.
But with any such oversight comes, again, the possibility of corruption. So it wasn't long before financial newspapers who set themselves up as arbiters of legitimate stock promotions also had very powerful incentives to push their own dodgy kinds of deals.
So let's talk about some of the famous figures in the history of fraud. P.T. Barnum, Charles Ponzi. Tell us how they shaped our understanding of this business.
Well, I'll start with Ponzi, actually, even though he comes later in the mix. So he, as many people know, ran a pyramid scheme in Boston in 1920 that eventually collapsed under the weight of public scrutiny and governmental prosecution. But Ponzi is interesting because he really shows the powerful importance of social bonds in being able to pull off a large-scale financial scam. Ponzi was a member of the Italian community in Boston, and that's where he found his most willing investors, offering fabulous returns on the basis of a supposed new idea in financial arbitrage in international trade. The only way he could make good on his promises was to have more people come in. That's the way a pyramid scheme works. And that momentum carried him through a good many months before eventually prying eyes realized there was nothing behind his approach.
How much was what he was doing, how much of what he was doing was actually illegal at that time?
It was in fact illegal, and he went to prison for the promises he was making that were fraudulent. That said, toward the end of the scam, he had begun to use some of the large sums that he had amassed to buy quite legitimate financial concerns. And if he had not been prosecuted, it's at least conceivable that he might have been able to convert all of the capital that he was amassing into legitimate business enterprise.
Of course, a lot of people say that's exactly what Wall Street is now. You're not investing in the idea of this company at all. You're investing, what you're doing is betting that when you buy this thing, it's going to be, the price will be lower than when you sell it.
So that difficulty of distinguishing outright deceit from enthusiastic puffery or exaggeration is something that's been with the United States from its inception. And Barnum points that out actually quite nicely. So Barnum was clearly a huckster. That's a name that was attached to him, at the label that was attached quite early on. But what did he actually do in his businesses? He was a promoter par excellence. He provided people with entertainment. And he developed a reputation for fakery. Everyone knew that lots of what Barnum presented was fake. One of the interesting things was trying to figure out how it was fake. Was that fundamental business proposition a fraud? The evangelical press thought so. In the mid-19th century. But on the whole, Barnum won the argument that what he was doing was perfectly illicit.
And everybody sort of bought in. And they were just, as you say, sometimes buying their ticket to try to figure out where the trick was. So let's talk about the stock market crash and when the government becomes more heavily involved in regulation.
So this is a very important turning point. By the 1920s, even before the stock market crash, more and more members of the business establishment, legal establishment, other professional groups were beginning to worry about the threat that widespread deceit posed not just to specific markets or to specific companies whose interests might be hurt by it, but actually to the economy as a whole. So there's a growing awareness of the larger macroeconomic costs associated with business fraud. And that only was sharpened by the dramatic impact of the stock market crash of 1929 and the ensuing Great Depression. So now one begins to see a much more substantial move by the federal government to assert jurisdiction over the flow of commercial speech. With the passage of the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934 being really important hallmarks of that shift.
And also what kinds of activities banks and other lending institutions could engage in, and created separations over time, various laws.
That's right. So this is the anti-deception elements of federal regulation are part of a much broader mosaic.
So a lot of this is undone in the 1990s, and voila, 2000 and then 2008, Glass-Steagall being one of those legislation that put up a partition. What happens over time? We only have a few minutes left, but there's a sense, certainly in the 1930s, that we need this. As you say, the whole economy now depends on this, not just a few individual investors. And there was a consensus around this, and it seems to have broken down over time.
Well, in the 1970s, and I think that's a crucial pivot point, the United States confronted some new economic challenges, stagflation, inflation right. with either poor growth or even negative growth recessions. And in the midst of that that set of challenges, a growing number of powerful voices from the right argued that we had to loosen up regulations in order to allow businesses to innovate and provide new opportunities and economic growth. And that had an impact on oversight of commercial speech and the truthfulness of it. So less so in terms of completely ripping out regulatory structures, more so in terms of limiting budgets for regulatory oversight and not regulating new kinds of markets that were emerging, say with financial derivatives, or some developments in the mortgage market in the 2000s. So there are proposals to regulate in these areas, and the deregulatory ethos was a key element in why those proposals were rejected.
So they make an argument. We have this stagflation, which is caused for a number of reasons. But what the business community argues is just let us just take off some of these rules and you watch the money flow and watch the jobs grow. Didn't quite happen that way. Then the market crashes in 2008. We see the elimination or, the, as you say, the loosening of some of these regulations. 2008 happens after these derivatives and other instruments are created. There were some warnings about the dangers of some of these derivatives and the fact that we didn't quite know the impact. There are a few regulations put in place, Dodd-Frank and others, and now we're seeing an impulse to reduce and eliminate again.
So I think the moment we're in is quite contingent. You can point to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau as a key aspect of Dodd-Frank, which tightened up oversight of a very important part of the economy involving consumer finance. And that also sought to structure those markets in ways that would provide consumers with better information, enabling them to make better decisions, but also to move to the side some of the more abusive types of financial contracts. And yet even before the election of 2016, there also were other actions taken by Congress, like the Jobs Act, which had the premise of loosening up oversight of information flows in the financial markets to improve the capacity of new firms to get access to capital. So this is very much an open debate before 2016, right. And now we're only seeing a deeper and more sustained attack on regulation of all sorts.
Stay tuned. Ed Balison, the author of the new book, Fraud, An American History from Barnum to Madoff. He's a professor of history and public policy at Duke University. Ed, thank you so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley's our technical director, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.